Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, King.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I am Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Someone mentioned to me this past week about the show may not quite be riveting. But what's overstatement in this age, right? But thanks again, Audrey, for getting us on the show. You do it perfectly every time. And we are literally a little more than a week away from 4 years of broadcasting on Blog Talk Radio. We got there just about as soon as it started, and now it has, who knows, 1 zillion shows that broadcast around the world. And you need to take a look at those shows, folks, as listeners, if you've not done that before. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Jumble Justice Radio Network. And before we go any farther, we have some congratulations to pass out, and it is for Ms. Audrey England. Yes, Audrey England got a review of the book that she narrated on archive.org. The book is my diet book called Three Bowl Diet. And Audrey reads the entire book on archive.org, and she got a very flattering comment this past week about how much they enjoyed that book, along with some smiles. So congratulations, Audrey, and we have more books in mind for you. But doesn't she, ladies and gentlemen, have the voice for narrating just about anything? Well, thank you again, Audrey, and let's move forward. Tonight, Johnny Cash, he would take us on that trip across 90 cities and states again, and we always stop at Dayton, Ohio. We could go farther, but I have fond memories of Dayton, having worked there once as a police officer. Yes, back in the Ice Age, I actually did that. And Johnny might stop off in Dayton because they're a homesteading city. You can actually homestead in Dayton. I think if you hang around 5 years on a property, you might get it free. So remember that, John. If you get tired of riding the roads and those trucks, then you can do that. You know, a show I watched here this past week, I'd only heard about it and watched little clips of it, but I watched a whole show on the History Channel. And Mike, I think you told me about it, the Ice Road Truckers. Have you seen that show? Whoa. They drive around on roads covered with full loads, covered on ice and snow, and they go uphill and downhill. I don't think I quite got the purpose of all that. It's kind of a race or a survival ride or something like that. But if you've not seen that on the History Channel, take a look. It's an odd kind of event. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for helping us tonight also, and you have parts throughout the show that people don't even know about. So the purpose of our show, ladies and gentlemen, is always to discuss news and issues, events, developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. What we try to do We dedicate the show to these tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals that protect us. And we try to look inside the practice of criminal justice and take a close-up look at the profession. I think tonight our presenter is Alexandra Adipoff, professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, is going to present her book called Snitching, The Erosion of the Criminal Justice System. How about that for a specific, interesting look at inside of criminal justice, the whole idea of snitches, of developing snitches the way federal, local, state agencies do it, and then how they get paid off, and then how they get, it goes awry sometimes, and she's done a nice job of documenting that. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio, and again, it is a leading edge technology still. Admiration of many, many people. Alan Levy started this about 4 years ago with the members of his family talking about passing in their family, and he was a telecom executive, and he turned this into this worldwide broadcast network, and yes, even President Obama has used it. So what's possible with this Blog Talk Radio is that any person, interest group, can have their own show. They can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it doesn't cost a penny. Think of that 10 years ago. If you were trying to do something like this, it was virtually impossible. So I haven't looked around much for college and university shows. There has to be some, but you know, college radio stations were hard to maintain sometimes. A lot of them went out of business. Well, now they can have a show and probably run it five or six times a week, recruit students, all sorts of things. So there's lots of ideas they can do with that. I mentioned to you tonight that our show is going to be about the book called Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice. And it's going to be Professor Alexandra Nadipoff, and she's from the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. And I think you're going to enjoy her presenting this book. It's really an interesting endeavor. You can call in during the news segment of the show if you like and comment on some of the news stories. They're always wild and a little bit crazy. I love the one we have tonight about Google, a couple stories about Google. Doggone it. Mike, explain that to me, how they keep making mistakes. But anyway, you can listen on your computer, and or you can listen on your phone, and you can call in if you want to during the news segment of the show at 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. All right, let's go ahead and move forward and see what we got going on here. Audrey has a blonde joke for tonight, and I was supposed to warn you. Audrey wanted me to let you know that the joke tonight is a little bit morbid, but it's close to what? Halloween time. We got Halloween coming up here very shortly, so she thought this joke would be good. If you happen to be joining us for the first time, I will point out that Audrey England, born in London, England, is a collector of blonde jokes. She has trunks full of them. She's been collecting them since a child. She's not offended by these jokes, and she doesn't mean to offend anyone else. So, Audrey, what do you got on that joke tonight? Let's go ahead and hear this. And I took a sneak peek of it. I think the people will like it.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke tonight is a little morbid, but it is in the spirit of Halloween, so I think our listeners will understand. Here it is. A man who just died is delivered to a local funeral home, and he is wearing an expensive, expertly tailored black suit. The female blonde mortician asks the deceased's wife how she would like the body dressed. She points out that the man does look good in the black suit he is already wearing. The widow, however, says that she always thought her husband looked his best in blue, and that she wants him in a blue suit. She gives the blonde mortician a bland check and says, "I don't care what it costs, but please have my husband in a blue suit for the viewing." The woman returns the next day for the wake. To her delight, she finds her husband dressed in a gorgeous blue suit with a subtle chalk stripe, and the suit fits him perfectly. She says to the mortician, "Whatever this cost, I'm very satisfied. You did an excellent job, and I'm very grateful. How much did you spend?" To her astonishment, the blonde mortician presents her with a bland check. "There's no charge," she says. "No, really, I must compensate you for the cost of that exquisite blue suit, she says. Honestly, ma'am, the blonde says, it cost nothing. You see, a deceased gentleman of about your husband's size was brought in shortly after you left yesterday, and he was wearing an attractive blue suit. I asked his wife if she minded him going to his grave wearing a black suit instead, and she said it made no difference, as long as he looked nice. So I just switched the head.
Okay, appropriate for Halloween. She just switched the heads. That is a great one, Audrey. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, we've been trying to assist the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms for years to get their public service announcement out about the danger of firearms and to get the crooks on the street to turn in their guns. And here's the message that they have for those criminals on the street who we hope will hear this tonight and do the right thing and go down and turn in their firearms to the local police department or some other public safety agency.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And what an important message we try to assist you with every week on our radio show for perhaps almost 4 years. We hope that message falls on the correct ears. Well, tonight we have another green tip. Do you remember last week? Wasn't last week, Mike, the one where we had the green tip about narrowing your font on your computer? So if you're printing pages out, you can have a narrower font, and that font can put more letters on a line, therefore more words on the page, and we can actually save paper. And I've actually changed my font in my email systems, and it looks a little skinny, like it might need a little food, but it actually works. You can get more letters on the line. But tonight is another interesting tip, and here we go with it. And I'm feeling guilty already, and some of you will when you hear this tip. This is from Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And here's tip number 729 concerning health and hygiene. She says, 10 treadmills in the average gym use the same amount of electricity in a day it would take you to run your hairdryer nonstop for a year. Stick to weights and non-electric machines like spinning bikes. Do you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? Get off of those treadmills. They use too much energy. Now the problem is, if I'm not going to use them, I know they make fine clothing racks, but they also, how are you going to dispose of them? So that's going to be an interesting thing. Maybe further on in the book, I've not read every word of Esma Floyd's book, but I've read lots of them, bits and pieces here and there. There must be something, a tip on what to do with the treadmills if you're not going to run them. Can't sleep on them now, but you can't hang clothes and stuff on them, so that would probably work. But anyway, that's a good tip. Stop running your treadmill, stop using electricity, and away you go. Well, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news. It's almost as insane as it always is. And let's start off with this one here tonight, which I think is an interesting one. I've been sort of tracking this story for about 8 or 9 years. let me see if I can pull it up here real quick. Come on, Evernote. I use Evernote to collect these news stories in case anybody's interested. If you haven't used Evernote, it's a fine web clipping service. And you can use their service, and I clip like crazy, and I only use about 1/30th of what my free size is. All right, here it is. The FBI, for nearly a decade, has been trying to establish a FBI computer system where to manage their case investigation files. And this is a Bloomberg News story just recently, I think it was yesterday. It says the computer system for the FBI, known as Sentinel, is $100 million over budget and 2 years behind schedule, said a report released one Wednesday by the Justice Department's Inspector General. As of August, after spending about $405 million of the $451 million budget, only two of the four phases of the project have been completed. Tom Harrington, he's Associate Director of the FBI, said the report did not accurately reflect the Bureau's management of the project and that it relied on outdated cost estimates and failed to credit the Bureau with taking steps to stay within the budget. Now, the precedent to this is the FBI has been working on this case management system for literally 7 or 8 years. I know that long because I was at a conference when I'm presenting a paper, and there was an agent there talking about starting their new computer system, and I think that was around the year 2000. And remember the first one? They started with this whole new computerized system for their case management file. They junked the whole thing, and it was over like around $100 million, threw it away. And then they started another one, and they had to revise some of that. So this may be the third or the fourth attempt that they have on getting this case management system going. Again, the FBI does wonderful things for us, but I think it's time to go to the Los Angeles Police Department or Dallas or someplace and get some idea about how you put one of these things together. I can't believe it's taken this long. Of course, their job is different and largely unmanageable in many ways, but I thought that was an odd one. This is kind of interesting. You know, you think sometimes that punishment is a little too serious here in the United States, where they're getting ready to execute this gentleman in Iran, and very interesting circumstance. He's an Iranian chocolate thief. An Iranian court has condemned a man convicted of robbing chocolate from a Tehran pastry shop. And he's going to have his hand chopped off. Judge Mohammad Reza Giyuki, quoted in the report, also sentenced the man whose identity was not revealed to 6 months in prison for damaging the shop and for disobeying the police. But before he does all of that, he took like $900 worth of chocolate, cocoa, and that sort of stuff. We're talking about a person with a chocolate addiction. But Islamic Sharia law of Iran lays down amputation as punishment for repeated theft offenses. It says cases of amputation have been increasing due to a rise in robberies in many of the poverty and backstreet areas of Iran. So it's hard to complain about some punishment in the United States. I don't think our shoplifters get their hands cut off. I'm sure of that. But boy, that's kind of a scary story, isn't it? Here's another one I think is interesting. It has to do with illegal immigration. Yes, we do have some in the United States. And let me see if I can pull this up. Where did that one go, Mike? Starts out with a president. He's in the title. President, where did you go? Oh, yes. Here we are. How do you like this idea? Gee, I didn't know I clicked all that, all those pictures and all those things. But anyway, we have a new policy, apparently, on deportation cases for people who are here illegally in the United States. Yes, we do have illegal immigrants. Some say as many as 22 million now. But anyway, it says the number of deportation cases being dismissed by Houston immigration judges has risen more than 700%. Says, according to the Executive Office for Immigration Review, 217 cases were dismissed in August, with another 174 dismissals occurring in September. In July, there were only 27 deportation cases in Houston. And what's happened is that the government's attorneys, the prosecutors, quote-unquote, are going to the defense attorneys defending the people here that are going to be deported and asking them to drop the case. And if you haven't committed some serious felony, then you're out the door. In fact, there's another story about that has more details. But the government is dropping all of these cases, and we're letting these people walk right back out onto the street and to disappear into the night, so to speak. and that's it. Isn't that incredible? I mean, we have laws against being in the United States illegally. Now our own prosecutors in our Justice Department are asking that these cases be dismissed unless they've committed serious felony. So if you're a shoplifter or you're repeated misdemeanor type of offenses or minor felonies, they're not violent, they're considering these non-harmful, and they're turning them loose right back into the community, and they're not being deported. Unbelievable. I mean, and some of them have false ID, some of them vote, some of them take jobs from people, but some of them, or all of them, came here illegally. So I think that's incredible that we just can't get this together. Both of our major political parties have walked away from the illegal immigration story twice now in the last several years. They just don't want to come to any conclusions on what to do about it. In the meantime, it means it's an open door. In fact, it's a swinging door. I talked to somebody in Los Angeles early part of the week, and she said that they go back and forth to work, not legally. The ones that actually have passes, that the illegals go back and forth across the border all the time. I'm not exactly sure how they do that. I haven't crossed that border in a long, long time in the San Diego area, but it actually happened. So an incredible kind of thing. You know, if California, I believe on the November 2nd is when it comes up for them too, they have on their ballot whether or not they're going to legalize marijuana. In other words, they smell the tax money, I think, from the marijuana. They're estimating that they'll be able to bring in billions. I'm not sure just because they make it legal that they're going to get all that tax money. I think I've heard of, like, illegal liquor, too, and cigarettes and all sorts of things. But A.G. Holder, Eric Holder, says the Obama administration strongly opposes this California ballot to legalize marijuana. And he's warning that the federal drug enforcement effort would be greatly complicated if this measure passes. And he's saying that if this happens, recent polls indicated voters narrowly favor passing the Regulate, Control, and Tax Cannabis Act. Yes, tax in capital letters. No, it's not caps, but it probably should be. Also known as Proposition 19 in next month's election. If they pass this thing, the measure would only affect state law, leaving intact the federal law that classifies marijuana as one of those controlled substances alongside cocaine and other kinds of drugs. So it's going to be interesting if that happens. We're going to have a clash here between, supersized California and the enormous size United States of America in terms of what's going to happen. And that's going to be a fun thing to watch. And my hunch is, I could be wrong, that this law will not pass. We'll have to see. They say it's narrowly ahead, but I think some people are going to come out of the woodwork and vote that would barely put this thing down. But we'll have to see what happens in that particular case. Here's kind of an interesting one. McDonald's, of all places, has come up with a way to find robbers and that type of thing. And let me see if I can find that story for you real quick. Rotterdam, there we go. When the McDonald's down from the city hall here was burglarized a few years ago, the article says, its managers decided they needed a new security system. It was just about the time they said that local police officers were offering something totally different that they hoped would stem a rising tide of robberies that occur mainly in the immigrant neighborhoods of this rough-and-tumble city. In the immigrant neighborhoods, they wouldn't commit crime there, would they? In the Netherlands, I guess they would. The new system involves an employee-activated device that sprays a fine, barely visible mist that's laced with synthetic DNA to cover anyone in its path, including the criminals, and simultaneously alerts the police to a crime in progress. This mist, it's only visible under ultraviolet light, carries DNA markers peculiar to that location, enabling the police to match the burglar with the place burglarized. Now a sign on the front door of the McDonald's prominently warns potential thieves of the spray's presence. It says, the sign says, "You steal, you're marked." Well, I'll be. How clever of McDonald's to do that. says they've yet to make an arrest using this system, the DNA system, but how's that for a little crime repression system, Mike? Do you like that idea of being sprayed with a little mist while you're going through your Big Mac? And somebody's robbing the place? I don't know. I guess that's harmless. It must be, this little mist. But if you kind of hear, you're eating your Big Mac and you hear a little something like that, I think I'd get up and leave. Well, maybe not leave the restaurant. They'll think you're the thief or something, but that's interesting. Who would have ever believed that something like that's going on? Well, our last news story tonight has to do with Google. Where do I pick? Let's start with Spain. Spain's Data Protection Authority said Monday it's filed a suit against Google because they're capturing data from Internet users when it collects its photos for its Street View. Does that story sound familiar? Emily, you tracked our news for us? Yes, it's happened in the United States. Google, as they walk along or drive along with their little car, you've seen pictures of it, I'm sure, on the Internet. They got that little camera sticking out of the top of their car. This little camera keeps accidentally collecting the data on people's computers. Now, isn't that amazing? I've had cameras before, and it's never collected data from people. I mean, it's never done it. It takes pictures, but it doesn't collect data. But now in Spain, they've done this, and Google's could face fines of up to 600,000 euros. That's $840,000 for each offense. They think they got them on something like 60,000 offenses. Those darn cameras, can you believe those cameras accidentally collecting all that data, house after house after house? And if that doesn't satisfy you, how about Canada? Canada's privacy watchdog accused Google Incorporated on Tuesday of violating the rights of thousands of Canadians by inappropriately collecting their personal information in buildings in their Street View camera service. And Google must tighten its privacy protections. Those darn cameras keep collecting data. I thought they took pictures. But here they're collecting data. What? I'm sure this was a complete surprise to Google. Well, maybe not, since it happened in the United States. It's happened now in Spain, and it's happened in Canada. And yes, in the Top Secret America report done by Dana Priest, that's at topsecretamerica.com, you will see that one of the agencies that at the 1900 in the United States, private agencies that contract with our national intelligence counterterrorism type of service is Google. Could there be talk about connecting the dots? No. You couldn't connect those two dots, could you, Mike? I wouldn't think so. Google apologizes. They said they are profoundly sorry for having mistakenly collected payload data, but it did not specify what steps it would take. They said, we've been working with the Office of Privacy Commissioner in Canada, and its investigation will continue to answer the commissioner's questions and concerns. But anyway, I think it's probably time to change their camera manufacturer, isn't it? See, you buy a camera, and it accidentally collects data off of somebody's computer. It's fascinating that Google would be caught up in such a scam like that, or would buy equipment that was that unpredictable. Really something odd. But anyway, I thought you'd enjoy that news story, and we all are affected by Google somewhere. How many times a week or a day when you're downloading something on your phone or whatever, they ask you for your location, right? And you know these phones can be turned on. Everybody does realize that. That's part of, I think, it is a federal law that, don't quote me on the exact nature of it, but federal law says if they want to listen to your phone, you've got it in your house or in your hand, that they can actually do that. So who knows what's next. This isn't Big Brother, as one article said. It's certainly Little Brother. Well, that's it for the news segment tonight, ladies and gentlemen. What we're going to do now is go ahead and listen to Professor presenter Case on snitching, and I think you're going to really enjoy this, because this is an in-depth look of the idea of developing snitches and paid informants, and the value it has for our criminal justice system, and also the things that it does that harms us and corrupts our
corrupts our system. And she's got some very good examples. One of the ones she starts out with right away as she makes her presentation, and it's in the first chapter of the book. So give us time to make the switch over here, and I think you'll enjoy it. This is Professor Alexandra Nadipoff. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, and the name of her book is Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Criminal Justice. And a little prelude to what she does there, she argues that the practice of recruiting or persuading those accused of crimes to inform on other criminals to obtain a lesser charge is eroding justice and leading to more crime. Some people said we couldn't run our system without the use of informants. That's certainly open to question. But here we go. Hold on just a second. It's working. Don't leave.
Argues that the practice of recruiting or persuading those accused of crimes to inform on other criminals to obtain a lesser sentence is eroding justice and leading to more crime. The Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. hosts this hour-long event.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. Special thanks to Professor Mezzi for making this happen. And thank you also to the American Criminal Law Review for hosting me today. I've relied on the American Criminal Law Review for years, so it's really wonderful to get to come here and speak in this context. So I'm talking today about my new book, but in some more fundamental sense, I am talking about features of our criminal justice system that we rarely discuss. And snitching is everywhere in our criminal system. What do I mean by snitching? I'm referring to the very specific law enforcement practice of trading criminal guilt in exchange for information. And so this talk in this book is not about everyone who gives information to the government. It's not about the citizen who calls 911. It's not about even informants who work for money, although many do. But it's about the specific public policy of permitting the trade of potential criminal guilt in exchange for information and cooperation. And I say snitching is everywhere in our criminal system in the following sense. It touches on and bears on almost every facet of the criminal process as we know it. It takes place on street corners when the police officer has to decide whether to pressure a suspect into cooperating or whether to arrest them at that moment. It takes place in jails and prisons where inmates know that if they come forward with information, they may get a deal. It takes place, of course, in prosecutorial offices when prosecutors have to decide which suspect should be the witness and which one should be the defendant in any particular case. It shapes FBI investigations and other federal and local and state law enforcement investigations. Of course, it's a central feature of plea bargaining as we know it. And especially in the federal system, it's a crucial feature of sentencing, the decision of how much, if any, credit a defendant should get for any cooperation they have rendered to the government. So it is in this sense that snitching is part of almost every piece of the criminal justice system, and this has deep implications for our legal system. It affects how we investigate crime. It affects who gets investigated for crime. It affects how we decide who is guilty and what they're guilty of and how they should be punished. And it affects people's perceptions of the legal system and their understanding of how law enforcement works. I'd like to start today the way I start the book, with a true story. 92-year-old Catherine Johnson was dead, which meant big trouble for Officer Smith and Junior. 3 hours earlier, everything had looked so promising. Atlanta police had busted Fabian Sheets for the third time in 4 months, and the local drug dealer turned informant had tipped them off to a major stash at 933 Neal Street, an entire kilo of cocaine. Sheets wasn't one of the registered informants, so they couldn't use him to get a warrant. But Smith and Junior applied for a warrant anyway by inventing an imaginary snitch. They called him a, quote, reliable confidential informant, unquote, and they told the magistrate judge that this non-existent snitch had bought crack cocaine at the Neal Street address. Well, the fabrication wouldn't matter in the end. After they got the warrant, busted in, and grabbed the kilo, it would be a major victory. But nothing went the way it was supposed to. Sheets' tip was bad. There was no cocaine at that address. Once inside the house, the officers opened fire. And now Mrs. Johnson was lying at their feet, riddled with police bullets, with no cocaine anywhere to be found. So Smith and Junior turned to one of their regular informants, yet another snitch named Alex White. They offered him $130 to say that he bought drugs at Mrs. Johnston's Neal Street home and to corroborate their false warrant application. It wouldn't bring Mrs. Johnston back, but at least no one would learn that they gambled everything on a weak lead from a bad snitch and that the informant and the warrant didn't even exist. I start with this story not only because it's true and not only because it triggered a congressional investigation, which it did, but because it's paradigmatic in many ways of the snitching phenomenon. The story begins, of course, with the police letting a known criminal offender walk in exchange for information, and this is the heart of the snitching deal. It is precisely in this way that many criminal informants are able to avoid liability for their crimes by providing information, and as it was in this story, all too often this information is inaccurate. The Atlanta police used their informant power both to rely on an unreliable snitch and to invent an informant to get a warrant, because they knew with near certainty that their decision to do so would never be scrutinized by a court. It is rare for a magistrate judge to require police to verify the identity or the information from a confidential informant. And so although, as you know, we have many mechanisms for ensuring the accuracy of information in warrants, often criminal informant use slips beneath this protective radar. And finally, police in this story used their informant power to cover up their own mistakes. And because informant use is so secretive and is so unregulated, it is easy for police and prosecutors to use informants in many ways to fill in gaps, to bolster shaky cases, to get a questionable warrant, and even to cover up errors, mistakes, or even wrongdoing on their own part. And so it is in this way that the tragedy of Mrs. Johnston's death tells us something about how our criminal system really works. I started by describing how criminal informant use touches on so many facets of our criminal justice system. But do we know more than that? Can we estimate how many criminal informants there really are in our system at any given time? And the first thing that needs to be said is that there is no direct data. There are no mechanisms to collect data on how many informants police and prosecutors create and rely on at any given time, what crimes they've committed, what crimes they've helped us solve. But we can piece together a more robust picture from data that we do know about how our criminal system works. And so one useful piece of data that people often turn to in this regard is federal sentencing data. The Sentencing Commission tells us that approximately 13% or 14% of all federal defendants receive some cooperation credit on the record in the form of a sentencing departure at sentencing, and about a quarter of drug defendants do. The Sentencing Commission also tells us that it believes that about half of cooperating defendants actually get credit for their cooperation. So if 25% of federal drug offenders actually get a sentencing departure, that means probably about 50% or somewhat more of drug defendants are actually cooperating. It's just that about half of them don't show up in the sentencing data. The Sentencing Commission also tells us that in every category of federal offense, criminal defendants receive cooperation credit, from child pornography to murder, as well as sort of the heartland cases of drugs and increasingly fraud and white-collar crime. So the entire federal criminal system is touched in these various ways by the power to turn a defendant into a cooperator. The problem with this data is that it's partial in any number of ways. First of all, it doesn't include most of the cooperation that we know about. In effect, it's the tip of the iceberg, of course. It doesn't include defendants who cooperate but don't get credit. But it doesn't include all those defendants who avoid being arrested or prosecuted in the first place by cooperating. It doesn't account for dropped charges or other benefits that cooperators might get, as well as a host of other kinds of benefits, such as immigration considerations and, of course, money and other payments. So it is, at best, a partial picture of cooperation in the federal system. And the federal system is actually quite a small percentage of our entire criminal justice system. It represents about a tenth of felony cases. 90% of all cases take place at the state level. So for what it's worth, the federal data gives us a glimpse, but a very partial one. We can, however, more generally, use drug enforcement itself as a rough proxy for figuring out how prevalent the use of the criminal informants really is in our system, because we know that informant use is at the heart of drug investigations, negotiations, plea bargaining, and sentencing. It's sometimes jested that every drug case involves a snitch, but anybody who's worked in the criminal justice system knows that it is par for the course for any number of the parts of a drug investigation to rely on or involve informants in some way. Well, that's about 30% of our criminal justice system. Drug cases make up approximately 30% of both federal and state dockets. And so we're talking about a significant portion of our system overall that is openly reliant on criminal informant use. And, of course, as we know from reading the paper about every 2 weeks, we see that criminal informant use is also becoming a more prevalent tactic in white-collar offenses, in fraud, hedge fund investigations, other means like that. So, well, we have a core area of informant use, and that use is spreading. So what we get is a dual dynamic, an important, powerful criminal justice tool that is used widely throughout the criminal system, that determines the outcomes of thousands of investigations and cases, and yet which is at the same time deeply unregulated and mostly secret and almost never comes to public scrutiny. In my view, this would make snitching interesting all by itself. But there is one more piece of the puzzle, and that is that the big overlooked cost of using criminal informants in the ways that we do is its impact on poor African-American neighborhoods. And this, too, is connected with the prevalence of the use of informants in drug enforcement. Because drug enforcement resources are so heavily concentrated in poor urban neighborhoods, we should expect the use of informants to be likewise deeply concentrated. And this has implications for those neighborhoods as well. What is the scale of the phenomenon that we're talking about? Well, again, we have no direct data. State and local law enforcement agencies do not collect data on the informants that they use or the crimes that are committed or solved by them. But we do know a lot, relatively a lot, about how drug enforcement works and the criminal justice system works in urban communities. Nationally, we know that approximately 30% of young African-American men between the ages of 20 and 29 are under criminal justice supervision at any given time. By itself, of course, a staggering number. But also a misleading number, right? Because it's the national average. So it's masking differences between different communities. There are going to be some communities in which that number is much, much lower. At the same time, there are going to be communities in which that number is significantly higher. For example, here in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, studies have shown that as many as half of the young men of that age range in any particular community might well be under criminal justice supervision at any given time. We think that about half of those people are under criminal justice supervision for drug-related reasons. And when I say drug-related, I mean either they're under supervision because they've actually committed a drug offense, buying or selling drugs. But they may have committed a drug-related offense in the sense that they commit a property offense as a result of their substance abuse problem. And a high proportion of Americans who are currently in jail or in prison committed their offenses in order to get money for drugs to feed their substance abuse habits. And so this half of that population, the population that is in connection with the criminal justice system because of drug use or because of a drug offense, this is an arena in which we would expect law enforcement to put pressure on suspects to become informants, because we know that this is typically how police handle these kinds of cases. So this quarter of the population is in a sense sort of high risk snitch arena. How many of these people actually become informants? Because of course the pressure to become an informant and actually choosing to do it, particularly in this world where becoming an informant can be high risk, is quite a different matter. And we can't know that directly. The police don't tell us. Perhaps not surprisingly, the offenders don't tell us. But we can make good guesses for the sake of argument. And I told you a few minutes ago that at the federal level, we know that approximately 50% of drug informants cooperate. So let's say that at the state and local level, it's half of that, right? That 25% of drug defendants cooperate in some way. If that were true, that would mean that about 1 in 16 of the young men in this age range in these neighborhoods is actually a criminal informant at any given time, about 6%. And 6% would be a lot. That's a lot of people in a community, in a family. Just by way of contrast, it's often said that approximately 10% of the East German population before the fall of communism were working as informants in some way with the Stasi secret police. And we often look at that society as a dysfunctional society precisely because we think that's an extremely high percentage of people who would be to be working with the government at any given time in that way. So 6% would be a lot. And so in these neighborhoods, it does not make sense to understand the use of criminal informants solely as a law enforcement tactic or as an investigative tool. On this scale, it becomes a form of social policy. It affects how people interact with each other, how they understand each other, and, of course, how they perceive the criminal justice system. What might this effect look like? Well, back in 1998, I was working in Baltimore. I had a fellowship from the Open Society Institute to do community lawyering work, and part of that fellowship involved teaching law classes in inner-city Baltimore neighborhoods. And one night, I was teaching such a class at a community center, and I'm sure that most of the students weren't listening to me, but there was one student who raised his hand, and he said, "I got a question." He was maybe about 12 or 13 years old. He said, "I got a question. So police let dealers stay on the corner because they're snitching. Can they do that? Can the police do that? Is that legal?" And when I explained to him that it was legal and that police have discretion to arrest or not to arrest offenders, he and his friends were disgusted. They said, "Oh, but the police aren't doing their job." And one said, "Oh, well, all you got to do is snitch and you can keep on dealing." And so for me personally, this showed me that it's important to understand that snitching has deeper implications and goes deeper than just the criminal justice system lets us know, that our criminal system sends messages to young people and to communities that can affect far deeper aspects of life than we think of when we think of them in law enforcement terms. So what to do? We have a system-wide phenomenon, and it raises systemic challenges. Before I talk about the central challenges that I think can help us organize our thinking about this phenomenon, I want to acknowledge that snitching is also an extremely powerful law enforcement tool. right? It's one of the only ways that law enforcement can often penetrate criminal organizations, gangs, Enron, terrorist cells. It is sometimes the only way for the government to work its way up the hierarchy of criminal offenders is to flip lower-level actors. And so I don't want to miss the value of this tool towards law enforcement ends and towards the appropriate end of punishing or forestalling crime. At the same time, we have radically underestimated the costs and dangers of this practice. While the system is well familiar with the benefits, the potential benefits of the practice, and many features of our law actually protect and promote those benefits, I think it's time to turn with equal respect to the dangers that this phenomenon promotes. So what are the great challenges of the system? Well, first and foremost, and probably the best known, is the challenge of unreliability. We know that informants often give unreliable information. It's in their interest to give unreliable information when their own lives and sentences are on the line. A few years ago, Northwestern Law School issued a study. Their Center for Wrongful Conviction studied all of the wrongful capital convictions about which we know. And they concluded that over 45% of those innocent people who had ended up on death row had ended up there because of the false testimony of a lying informant, making snitching the largest single source of error in U.S. capital convictions. What this statistic says to me is not only that snitches are unreliable, but also that police and prosecutors rely on them, and that when these cases go to trial, juries believe them. So there's a way in which our system is not well protected against the dangers of unreliable informant information. And while unreliability is a terrible problem, particularly when it leads to wrongful convictions, there is perhaps a more fundamental challenge, which is that snitching, in many ways, turns our criminal justice system on its head because it prizes information over the prosecution of crime. Usually, we think of law enforcement as obtaining information in order to arrest and prosecute or deter wrongdoers and to find out who they are. But criminal informant use flips that on its head and permits the government to use its power over liability to ignore crime or even tolerate crime in order to protect its information sources. The use of a criminal informant inherently requires toleration. Of course, first it requires the toleration of the crime that the informant already committed. That's the snitch deal. We let you off in exchange for information. Active informants, however, typically, particularly in drug enforcement, continue to commit offenses in order to generate more information in ways that are authorized by the government. So the Department of Justice has a series of iterations of guidelines for the use of informants in the criminal system, and the guidelines that govern the FBI provide for two tiers of criminal activity that can be authorized by a handler, Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 1 includes selling drugs with no expectation of their recovery, engaging in acts that might lead to somebody else committing an act of violence, serious offenses, and Tier 2 are all other crimes. On the recognition that informant handlers are going to authorize their informant to commit more crimes, above and beyond crimes that they've already committed. And even above and beyond these two, police and prosecutors routinely acknowledge with concern that criminal informants will often continue offending, knowing that their relationship with the government will provide them some protection and some leeway in the event that they get caught. And all too often, law enforcement considers this sort of the cost of doing business in the dirty world of using informants. Perhaps the most infamous example was the FBI's long-running debacle in its handling of its mafia informants, particularly in Boston, but also elsewhere. Two Irish mob informants named Whitey Bulger and Stephen the Rifleman Fleming. You know, when you work with someone whose middle name is Rifleman, you're asking for trouble. They worked with the FBI for decades in Boston, and they were considered such valuable sources of information that their handlers, particularly FBI agent John Connolly, covered for them that they committed murder, racketeering, money laundering. Connolly himself is serving 10 years now for conspiracy and racketeering charges. But Congress called this episode one of the worst in FBI history, and it shouldn't surprise us that the episode involves the agency's heavy reliance on criminal informants. The crimes that informants commit need not be this dramatic. Routine practice in drug enforcement for police and agents to understand that their informants will continue their illegal drug use and can often continue their illegal drug dealing. Many police and prosecutors acknowledge that they expect their informants to so-called skim drugs off the top of controlled buys, either for their own use or for resale. And again, many informants use their relationship with the government to ease their way around liability for other crimes that they commit. So we have an investigative technique that requires the government to tolerate or ignore crime. And particularly in high-crime neighborhoods, where informants are remaining at large, remaining at home because of their cooperation, the cost of these crimes are borne by the community. They are borne by the friends and the family and the neighbors of the people who come home and continue to commit these offenses. And this is a hidden cost of informing that is rarely counted in the calculus of whether and when this is a good public policy or not. I would note, just by way of comparison, that some European countries have rejected this compromise. They've decided that the government shouldn't be in the business of tolerating and promoting crime. And in those countries, there are much stricter restrictions on how law enforcement can use informants and what crimes an informant can work off by providing information. So ours is not the only way of handling this problem. The final great challenge, I think, of using criminal informants is its effect on the transparency and accountability of our criminal justice system in general. In effect, a snitching deal is a way of resolving a person's criminal liability off the record and under the table in direct negotiations with a police officer or sometimes a prosecutor. And this flies in the face of many of our most cherished principles of criminal justice, whether it's the idea of the public trial or due process, or even the idea that the public should know how criminal offenders are being handled by our government. Because snitching is so secretive, it means that not only the public, but courts and legislatures are unlikely to ever learn the actual way that the criminal law is being enforced. And this is a significant cost of using criminal informants that also tends to go unaccounted for. So I want to leave plenty of time for discussion. So in the interest of time, I want to end by talking about the possibilities of reform. I devote an entire chapter of the book to it. It's a very exciting time for reform in the world of informants. There are a number of states who are taking on different ways of looking at this question, but I want to mention just one. But before I do that, I want to explain why I talk about reform in the way I do. I don't advocate banning the practice of using informants, and given the tone of the last half hour, you might legitimately ask me why. It's because the use of informants are part of much deeper choices that we have made about the way we structure.
Ladies and gentlemen, that about does it for tonight. I wanted to leave that on long enough for you to get a good feel for the book. You can see it on booktv.org, and we'll be seeing you next week. Look for the billing, and we're going to ask Vera Lynn to take us off here for the evening.
We meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. true, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was